WBUR. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Vice President Cheney said it's not a matter of if, but when there will be another terrorist attack on America. Pieces of intelligence drift in, rogue elements of a shadowy jigsaw puzzle. Capitol Hill is calling for hearings on the last failure to connect the dots before 9/11. Would an investigation now compromise the very agencies we rely upon for protection? Should all available time and money be spent fighting terrorism with time for reflection later? Or must we look back to go forward with confidence? We begin tonight with a look at chatter. White House officials said over the weekend that disturbing intelligence chatter, possibly indicating a coming terrorist attack, is running high volume and ominous. Earlier, I spoke with Wayne Madsen, former security specialist with the National Security Agency and State Department. I asked him exactly what kinds of information the administration is talking about when it talks about intelligence chatter.
Well, it primarily comes from two sources. One is signals intelligence. This is what the NSA, National Security Agency, does. They basically listen in on all forms of communications, which is regular phone lines, cellular calls, satellite phone calls, also internet emails. So, and obviously they're not listening to everything, but NSA, the way they work, they target certain areas where they, for example, may know that there's some history of this type of terrorist activity. Obviously, Pakistan is a target. Saudi Arabia is a target.
So they reduce the size of the vast haystack by geographically isolating places to pay a special attention to the details of what's being communicated?
Right. Geographically, and also where they know that there's certain cells present. For example, in Europe, we know about London and Hamburg and Paris. Actually, we know that from what happened on September 11th, because many of the al-Qaeda cells were operating out of European cities as well as South Asian cities. So,
but even with that targeting, there must be thousands and thousands of calls and emails. How do they sift through that to get a sense of, you know, we're talking about connecting the dots all the time now. How do they know which bits of information are the dots?
Well, obviously, they're looking at maybe phone numbers that they already know have been in the past used by various cell members. They're also obviously listening for keywords, and not in English, because many of these words would be in Arabic or potentially Urdu, the language of Pakistan, or Pashto, the language of southern Afghanistan. And they can basically go through with these various filters and filter out all the wheat from the chaff.
Is that filtering done by computer or by rows and rows of human beings?
No, because of the volume, it is actually done by computers using very sophisticated programs.
So that's the signals intelligence, the kind of electronic eavesdropping. There's another kind, you say, of chatter?
Yes, and that comes from the human intelligence sources. These are the people that, you know, our agents overseas are supposed to cultivate relationships with. That didn't work so well before September 11th, but we've got people on the ground in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Saudi Arabia, in Malaysia, and various other capitals where some of these contacts, not saying that they're members of al-Qaeda, but they, you know, are people who basically travel in similar circles and pick up bits and pieces. So this is the human intelligence factor. Sometimes the CIA may have to pay people for information. Other times they just may be friendly agents of influence that pass it along as a sort of a favor.
And would human intelligence include interrogation of al-Qaeda prisoners at Guantanamo and elsewhere?
It would. That gets into a little different kind of human intelligence. But if they're the people who are captured and are in Guantanamo or people who are still being held in Afghanistan, could be people who are being rounded up in Pakistan and placed under arrest. For example, the people who are now, you know, accused of being involved with the murder of Danny Pearl. So, yeah.
So when we talk about volume of this kind of chatter, when Condoleezza Rice says there's a lot, high volume, and it's ominous, what does a big volume mean? What's a lot and what's a little? The world must be full of comments, remarks, observations.
Oh, and they are. We've got two major Sunni Muslim holidays coming up in just a few days. So, yeah, there's probably a lot more chatter over the internet and phone calls. So the job is of the analysts to go make sure that, you know, if they're talking about a big celebration, it doesn't have anything to do with the Islamic holidays.
Which are those holidays, Wayne Madsen?
Well, there are two Sunni holidays coming up on the 20th and the 21st.
So a lot of this could be Islamic holiday greetings being communicated around the world.
It could be, and you know this is the problem with the intelligence analysts.
Then, given the volume of anti-American rhetoric in some quarters, the celebration of blows against the United States, What makes chatter more or less ominous? How do you discern a period, a moment, a week in which the chatter really grows ominous?
They're probably looking at going back and looking at some of the so-called chatter before September 11th. Many of these cell members use code phrases. They don't say we're going to plant a bomb in a certain place. They use so maybe they're hearing some of the same phraseology being used now, comparing it, what they're hearing today, with what happened in the months preceding September 11th. So that all plays a part in it. The part of the job of an intelligence analyst is to also look at trends and how what's going on now compares with what has gone on in the past. And not just before September 11th, they may also be looking at what happened before the bombing of the Khobar Towers, the bombing of our embassies in East Africa, and the bombing of the USS Cole.
And now that the minds of U.S. intelligence services have been focused by 9/11, do you think they can do a better job of interpreting the chatter they're hearing today than they did last September?
Well, one of the things Condoleezza Rice said is that they're paying much more attention to foreign intelligence reports now than they have in the past. On the other hand, they say they didn't get anything specific before September 11th, but there was a lot of intelligence coming in from foreign intelligence agencies that was extremely specific. In some cases, some of these reports mention the World Trade Center, mention hijacked commercial planes. One of the problems the CIA and other intelligence agencies have is they have a philosophy of NIH, not invented here.
I mean, if it wasn't invented in their agency, they're not prone to use it or admire it.
Well, yeah, and they don't want be put in an embarrassing position of having the president briefed. Mr. President, this intelligence comes from the Philippines, this comes from Kazakhstan, this comes from Russia. Because the question will be asked is, why do they have it and you guys don't?
Uh-huh.
Trying to justify increased budgets constantly that these intelligence agencies, and that's what they do, they want to limit the amount of intelligence given to the president that they have to say, look, the source of this is Israel, France, Russia, Indonesia, India, or wherever. So that's just the philosophy that's always been maintained at the CIA, and I certainly hope that changes now because there was some very good intelligence coming in from foreign agencies before September 11th.
And Wayne, given how deeply into the grain of American life the terrorists were last September, and given that we've heard Osama bin Laden hasn't used cell phones for a long time, and given how rudimentary some of the attacks could still be on water supplies and so on, what are the chances that we'll actually get a heads up about the next attack through this stream of chatter?
I'm a little bit worried about that because I think that there were people in place that their jobs were to fuse all this intelligence together and get it to the president. You know, obviously there's people who are entrenched in the national security infrastructure who I think the president really has to take a look with all these current threats being talked about, maybe replacing some of his national security team. I mean, we saw that happen after Pearl Harbor. They court-martialed the poor admiral in charge of Pearl Harbor who wasn't responsible for it, but, the heads rolled back then.
It doesn't sound like a big vote of confidence from you.
No, I'm afraid that all these dots were present before September 11th, and I would say not only were the dots there were some lines already there between the dots, and people that defend the administration can say all they want that we didn't connect the dots, but how about connecting some of the lines that were already drawn between the dots for them? They seem to have failed to have done that.
Wayne Madsen, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Wayne Madsen is a former communications security specialist with the National Security Agency. Vice President Dick Cheney says terrorists will strike again. The American people want to know when, where, and how. If possible, they want to be protected. At the same time, Capitol Hill is calling for answers about the last attack on 9/11. Who knew what, when, and could disaster have been averted? Tonight, we're asking, would an independent investigation allow America to look back and learn vital lessons from September 11th before another attack? Or would it waste the time, energy, and secrecy of the very forces we rely upon to protect us? Serious players are arguing both sides of the question. You can join the conversation as well tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs is political scientist and research fellow Jim Walsh. Good evening and welcome, Jim Walsh.
Thanks very much, Tom. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you. And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, Jim Walsh, I guess to go straight to the bottom line, can the country afford a major investigation of what went wrong in advance of 9/11 at the same time as it's facing, we're told, imminent, perhaps, security threats right now? Or from another perspective, is it absolutely necessary that we have that investigation? Which is it? Is it too costly or is it Is it just necessary?
Well, I think the question should be reversed, and we should ask, can we afford not to look at the causes of 9/11? All the more so because we may be facing a threat in the near term. We desperately need to find out what we did wrong in the past so that we can take the actions to correct that. And it's not the sort of thing where we can dally on this, wait a year, wait a couple of years. The vice president himself has said that it's certain that we will be hit, and the time frame that he talks about is, you know, it may be a day, it may be a month, it may be a year. But the year, 12 months, is basically the time frame he was talking about.
Within that time, and the suggestion is it could be any time.
Exactly. So to me, the clock is ticking. And it's incumbent on us to do everything we can to put ourselves in a position to try to foil any future terrorist attacks. And that means figuring out what we did wrong before.
And then today, FBI Director Robert Mueller just today said that walk-in suicide bombers in the style we've seen in Israel are inevitable in the United States. But we have seen investigations in the past, and I think the public perception of investigations, especially independent investigations, is that they go on and on and on. They consume zillions of dollars. Never mind that, they consume hours and hours of the people who are under investigation. Is there a risk of paralyzing the top people in the very agencies who need to have their attention glued on what's coming up?
Well, I can certainly understand why people would be skeptical about investigations. And, you know, most of our memories of investigations involve today impeachment and Whitewater and all of that going back to the Clinton administration. But the fact of the matter is that we've had independent inquiries and congressional hearings on every topic from Social Security to the assassination of JFK and everything in between. And we do that because we need to find out what problems are in order to fix them. I think it's highly unlikely that any of the officials currently involved in prosecuting the campaign against terrorism would be inhibited from being able to do that because there's a commission that's trying to find out what the facts are. And I think, if anything, in the end, it'll help them do a better job. Yes, is there a cost? Does it take time? Sure. But let's weigh that time and cost against the consequences of a terrorist attack. It seems to me that when we're going to spend $40 billion in a supplemental budget this year or other monies and other time to try to stop terrorists, job number one is to figure out what we did wrong so that we're in a better position to prevent something in the future.
The position you take suggests that it wasn't just an oversight last summer, but that there were structural problems of some kind that need to be addressed.
Well, I've been asked in the last week on repeated occasions, you know, who dropped the ball? Was this the president's fault? It seems to me that we don't know the answer to that question. We don't know the answer to that question because we don't have any facts about what's happened. It took 9 months. 9 months later, we find out that there was a briefing. 9 months later, we find out there are these other facts. So I think I worked.
Is that too long? Is that wrong of the Bush administration?
I think that was absolutely. And I think most of the polling showed the American public agreed with that. I think we have to be cautious here. I work with historical documents a lot. I do a lot of historical work, and it's easy to judge the past based on your knowledge of the present. So we don't want to make that mistake. On the other hand, there's incompetence out there. People make wrong judgments about things, even if they don't mean to. But if we're going to ever make any progress, we need to identify the problems.
Jack Beatty, rip it all up or steady as she goes to keep our eye focused on future threats.
Well, if in the world's greatest war, FDR, within days, if not hours, of Pearl Harbor, appointed an independent commission under Supreme Court Justice Owen Roberts to investigate what happened, and if the result of that commission was the firing of the general and admiral involved and others involved, it seems to me that if that can happen within the shadow of Nazism and attack from Japan, it hardly can stand comparison today.
So you don't have a fear, Jack, that the lineup of officials before Congress or before an independent commission would be taken away from the big banks of TV screens where the next threat is unfolding?
I don't know, and I just agree that because this was a systemic failure, as Pearl Harbor was, mm-hmm. you have to get at the system. You have to figure out where it went wrong. You have to lay that out. The people who are in power now are the same people who made those mistakes. They have every reason to hide them.
Heads have not rolled. Listeners, we're asking, can we dissect and defend? Can we investigate past security performance and be safe at the same time? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight whether the United States can afford to dissect failings that might have led to 9/11 and simultaneously defend the country against potential future attacks, which we are told are inevitable and perhaps even soon. Can we investigate past security performance and still be safe? Today, I'm joined tonight by Jim Walsh. He's a political scientist and research fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Jim Walsh, what about the political paralysis fear here? To what extent could this, can this investigation keep from being made into a political football that goes way outside the real material issues at hand and turns into something to set up, you know, Democrats or hurt Republicans in advance of the midterm elections this fall?
Well, I can understand why people would be worried about it being a political football, but it seems to me that the early data on this shows that the American public tends to take their time on drawing decisions. If you looked at the polling data over the weekend, you saw that there was concern that the information was released 9 months after the fact, but there wasn't any sort of rush to judgment that President Bush was, in fact, guilty of some sort of a mistake or crime, which I think is basically the appropriate response. I mean, holding people accountable, that's what democracies do. That's one of the great strengths of democracies. If we waited until there was absolutely no politics in order to investigate mm-hmm. some wrongdoing, we would never have an investigation.
We wouldn't be a democracy, I suppose.
And we wouldn't be a democracy. The reason why authoritarian governments often make mistakes because they have lots of yes men and yes women, people who never challenge the dominant idea, or in countries in which secrecy is so severe, you never learn about problems, and then those problems get worse. The strength of a democracy, especially against a terrorist group, is that it can learn from its mistakes. It's mature enough to be able to look at a problem and say, yeah, we did this wrong, but we can do better next time.
All right, Jim Walsh, you're in charge of the investigation. We hear from your comments already that you have serious concerns. Where would you point the first spotlights?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to follow the paper trail of the paper we're already aware of. We know, of course, that there were briefings.
The August 6th memorandum, morning memo to the president?
Exactly. And that's right, the daily briefing that he gets from the CIA. Now, we're not going to see those documents. Those documents, even under any investigation, will probably be either withheld or sanitized.
Cheney said no way over the weekend is he going to give those up. Even that one-and-a-half-page memo to Congress seems stingy.
Well, on these issues, this administration has been stingy in general. There's no administration in recent memory, going back even before President Bush's father, that has held information so closely to the vest. And I don't mean simply in national security, but government archives. President Bush changed the rules on what scholars would have access to.
We're going to come back to that, but
sure.
Take us on through the list of things where you would first.
Okay.
Where would you put the fork
in? As an archive rat, I would want to follow the paper trail. And that means, what were the other documents that that the agent in Phoenix wrote and sent? What were the documents that were written in response to that document? When the president gets briefed later, this is a separate mm-hmm. trail now, when the president gets briefed from the CIA, it suddenly doesn't appear on a piece of paper in the morning. There's a whole process that leads up to the generation of that finding, and you'd want to look at the lower level findings.
Two questions then. First of all, do the documents we've already seen or know of, do they suggest failings, significant failings to you? And secondly, given what we've seen, do you expect that there's a lot more that we haven't seen?
Well, in answer to the second question, absolutely yes. There is a lot more here that we haven't seen and that will come out, and I think that's a healthy thing. But we've seen that process in full just in a period of 7 days. We had the first disclosure by CBS Evening News, and since then, several more things have come to light that no one had anticipated. As to whether we can identify mistakes now or not, again, I think we really have to wait, and we have to show some restraint and let the data speak for itself in some sense. But we do know that there are problems, because already in the past week, the story has changed.
What changes, and what kind of problems are these documents likely to suggest?
Well, what has changed is what appears to be somewhat of a battle now between the FBI saying it did inform the CIA mm-hmm. that there were these problems and that we should be aware of this, and the CIA claiming that they were unaware of it. So clearly, even at the level of the documents that we have, there are questions that have to be asked. We can't continue to have a campaign against terrorism when we don't know who's talking to who and who's responsible. It's simply a non-starter.
Will heads roll if there's a thorough investigation?
Well, I don't know. I mean, unfortunately, that is often part of this, sometimes justified, sometimes not. But I think we have larger responsibilities here. And the larger responsibilities are to the families of the victims and to ourselves. We have a public policy responsibility to do things, even if they are costly, to try to prevent a worse cost, a worse consequence later on. So I can't predict. I wouldn't guess it would be wholesale firings. We wouldn't see scores of people being fired.
Jack Beatty, give us the context for this moment in this debate. I guess the Bush administration context and the congressional or Democratic Party context.
Well, as Mr. Wall said, the Bush administration has really taken a kind of imperial line vis-a-vis Congress. The last time Vice President Cheney said on public television that he thought it was risky, that a risk of executive prerogative to make documents public, those documents would have thrown light on his deliberations in the shaping the Bush energy program in relation to Enron. So the self-interested quality of that is just striking. As for the Democrats, you know, I think that they really made a mistake last week with some of the language and with some of the almost eagerness with which they pounced on this. People died here, and I don't think it serves them at all to be trying to make anything out of this. Rather, you should look at people like Senator Shelby from Alabama, a Republican, who has been and continues to be one of the most vehement critics of the security agencies, the FBI and the CIA. And he's been saying for months that he wants more action. Today's Washington Post reports that the Joint Committee charged with investigating September 11th has gotten nowhere, that there are just fundamental political differences within the committee and the staff and so on. And this, of course, points, it seems to me, more and more for the need for an independent commission that could move with dispatch.
Jack, Jim, well, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Larry Wartzel. He's a counterintelligence and counterterrorism expert with the Heritage Foundation. Good evening and welcome, Larry Wartzel.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Larry, so far we've got a unanimous let's investigate vote here with our guests and analysts tonight. I guess the question to you is, should we dive into an investigation of who knew what and when they knew it before 9/11? And if we shouldn't, why not? And if we should it be in Congress or in an independent commission?
Well, there's no question that the whole sequence of events needs to be looked at. And in my view, it needs to be looked at by the committees of the Congress that have both the authority to appropriate money and authorize legislation to correct the problems in the intelligence community. I think the intelligence and law enforcement communities are not working closely enough together. They need to be integrated, particularly on matters concerning terrorism, because it crosses the boundaries of both intelligence and law enforcement when you go to prevent it. And it is impossible to prevent future acts. And that's what we should be focusing at, preventing future acts, making the system work, putting together an intelligence fusion system, that a center that will allow agencies together to interrogate databases, be able to inquire what's going into databases, and to really collate these things.
Should this be an independent commission established to pursue this investigation?
You know, I have been on two independent commissions appointed by Congress, one to look at some CIA things and one to look broadly at trade and security with China. They're wonderful things. They take a very long time. They're responsible people. But they are not nonpartisan. They are just as bipartisan or partisan in the end. But the big difference is, in some cases, you can go a year waiting for people to get security clearances. It should go to the committees. The House and Senate Select Intelligence Committees are the proper places. The breakdown, I think, in Congress is that the judiciary and the intelligence committees have never worked together on this and aren't looking at it together.
Jim Walsh, how about it? Can Congress satisfactorily handle this investigation, or does it need to go to an independent commission?
Well, I think Larry makes several good points. Certainly, it's part of Congress's traditional oversight responsibility. That's sort of what they do. They're supposed to be overlooking executive agencies and seeing if they're doing a good job, and they're the ones appropriating the money, as Larry said. I'm sort of agnostic on the issue of whether it should be an independent commission or congressional hearings. Frankly, I don't see why they both can't happen concurrently, and if the nonpartisan commission takes a year or 2 years or whatever its tenure is that it's given, that's fine, and we can. That doesn't preclude the possibility of other sorts of investigations as well, and perhaps we'll learn different things from different groups. How partisan they are, that depends so much on the nature of the individuals that are appointed.
Jack Beatty, you suggested it ought to be independent.
Well, I don't have a strong feeling about that. I just want it to get done, and it does strike me as very strange that this committee has really made so little headway. I do note that one of the House members, Porter Goss of Florida, either was a I believe was a former CIA man and has consistently shown a willingness to carry water for the CIA. For example, last week in a press conference, he said that his one of his main beefs was that this information had been leaked. Well, of course, that's one way to look at it. But since the information threw an unflattering light on the CIA, and since he seems to be going out of his way, or at least in his public statements, to defend them, that doesn't fill me with confidence in his objectivity. You know, this wasn't the only time, in fairness to the Bush administration, we've been surprised. We were surprised when the North Koreans invaded South Korea. We were surprised when the Chinese ended the war later that year. We were surprised by the building of the Berlin Wall. And if you look back at Admiral Morrison's book on the Two Ocean War in World War II, it's extraordinary that the parallels between Pearl Harbor and this incident. Then, as now, there was an intense month just before the attack of noise and of information, a war warning. And then it went away, and there was a kind of lethargy. Everyone had geared up for an attack in November. It went away, and they forgot about it. Something similar happened here. There were noises in July. They all geared up, and then it kind of relaxed. And he says again and again, the noise overwhelmed the message. That could come right out of our current briefings. He says, it was nobody's particular and exclusive business to study all intelligence-marked material and come up with an estimate. Nobody got anything but excerpts and driblets. He points out how the Army did not share its intelligence with the Navy. This could come right out of the CIA, FBI. And he really finally comes back to say no one person knew the whole picture, the intelligence data disclosed.
So there's a lot of history here. This pattern has occurred more than once.
Yes, and then as now, it took a lot of things to go wrong. And I think the Bush administration shouldn't think, well, it's just us. It isn't just them. Tenet is a Clinton appointee. Some of this stuff goes back to the Clinton administration.
Way back, even the papers we've seen already. You know, can we investigate without descending into political paralysis? Is this a time when we urgently need accountability or urgently need all hands on deck in defense of the nation? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Dana's on the line. Welcome, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. The speaker just referred to what I was going to ask, that how much of this information goes back to the Clinton administration. And in hindsight, we don't know how many layers is there. But right now, we are basically investigating to some extent in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we have independent media or the committees in the houses. Have we given the chance to administration themselves?
Well, let's put
that. Investigate. If we weren't happy with their results, then we start to do all these investigating probes.
It is a question that keeps coming up. Let's put it to our guest, Dana. Thank you for your call, Larry Wurtzel. The White House and Republicans laid into Hillary Rodham Clinton for criticizing President Bush. The suggestion being, look, you guys laid this egg, and we had to live with it. How much of this is likely to go back? The finger pointing into the Clinton years.
Well, the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 happened under President Clinton. The 98 embassy bombings happened under President Clinton. The fact of the matter is that up until the time President Bush correctly declared war on terrorism, every terrorist act was treated as an individual criminal act. And that was a huge mistake. I think we've learned from that.
Jim Walsh, do you agree that the finger pointing will go back that far? How much, how will or should the blame be apportioned?
Well, again, my focus here is really not blame. I'm coming at this from the perspective of a scholar and trying to analyze a problem, a breakdown, so that we can come up with recommendations so that the breakdown doesn't happen again. And I, as a scholar, you always want more data, and I think it would be useful to go back to the Clinton years because then that would allow us to get some context, to sort of compare how Clinton handled the same information compared with Bush.
This clearly didn't grow up in 8 months.
Exactly. Now, there is some issue, and it would apply to any new president, where you come into office, you're putting your new team on the ground, and anything the previous administration did was by definition wrong. So any hint they give you, any suggestion that they should follow up, is rejected. So there may be
then President Bush wouldn't have kept George Tenet and wouldn't continue to express great confidence in George Tenet. I think what really needs to happen is, and what has not happened yet anywhere in the intelligence community, is a genuine... We do not have a national fusion center for intelligence on counterterrorism.
Well, that's what keeps coming up again
and again. There is no single place that the data that comes into the entire intelligence and law enforcement communities can be stored, accessed, interrogated, call it collated, through data mining technology or analysts, where you can come up with basic conclusions about what might happen.
Clearly, that's a terrifying absence. Let's get one more call before the break. Marcia is on the line. Welcome, Marcia. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to speak to your original question, mm-hmm. which was whether or not, as a society, we can deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
The questioning, and I want to say yes, that we can and we must, and it's important. Actually, I have a lot of respect for Vice President Cheney, but was pretty dismayed with his behavior lately about not wanting to question. I have no idea what country he thinks we are in, but as far as I'm concerned, a part of America's unique strength is the ability to question and move forward at the same time. So to me, it's really critical that we ask these questions, and I'm not clear why people can't just say, you know, there are breakdowns in the systems. We need to correct them. It stretches back to Clinton's administration. It happened under mine, and I need to take responsibility for this. As far as I'm concerned, we're paying enough tax dollars for people to take responsibility for their behavior.
You tell them, Marcia. Let me put that to Larry Wartzel before the break, and thanks for the call. Larry, how about it? Has the Bush administration been forthcoming enough? We've just got 30 seconds before the break.
I think they've been very forthcoming. The leaks you see coming out are, I think, right out of competing ends of the intelligence and law enforcement community, the CIA and the FBI. The National Security Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, and CIA are pretty well integrated. They share all their intelligence online.
But do they share it with the public like they ought to?
FBI and CIA do not.
Mm-hmm. But
FBI is not online. It's not integrated.
Mm. Well,
good agency, but it's not really integrated in the community.
Urgent to do that. Larry Wartzel, thanks for joining us tonight.
I'm happy to be with you.
Larry Wartzel is with the Heritage Foundation, a counterintelligence and counterterrorism expert. We're talking about investigating past security performance and trying to be safe today. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Do we need a full investigation of pre-9/11 readiness, or will it get in the way of current national security? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about national security, pre-9/11, post-9/11. There are major calls for investigation now of what we knew and when we knew it before the September 11th attacks. Can we, as a nation, dissect and defend at the same time? Can we investigate past security performance and be safe today? And I guess the question is, are we getting the whole story from the Bush administration even now? Should we get the whole story now? Is it safe for it to come out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I am concerned about kind of the debate on this issue because it leaves out one major question, which is why it is that we were not given this information before September 11th in light of the purported impact it would have on the airline industry.
Yeah.
Condoleezza Rice more or less admitted this in her briefing last week, but somehow if this had been given out to the American public, it could have shut down the airline industry. I don't think that we should be playing the game of worrying about the bottom line dollar when it comes to people's lives?
It's a good question, John. I'll put it to Jim Walsh, and thank you for your call. Jim Walsh, should this have come out? Could American Airlines have responded to it, American security agencies? Or is this such a are there so many warnings like this that we'd be always paralyzed if we responded to every one?
Well, that's a good question, Tom. The I think part of what I would say is, well, two things. First, there's a story out today that the FAA had information. They didn't pass on all the information that they had, and there seems to be some regret within the agency for not having done that. I think, though, the broader question is, could have we done anything? Should we shut down the airports? There are lots of things that might have happened if we'd been lucky or if the system worked better that would have been far short of shutting down the airport. We wouldn't even have to have gotten to that step. So, for example, if the Massawi arrest and the Phoenix memo and the CIA briefing had somehow all been put together, simply sending an email to every flight training school in America saying, do you have foreign students?
Let's look twice here.
Send an agent. We have agents all over the U.S.
That is the most galling thing. That sounds now, 2020 hindsight,
absolutely.
So easy.
And I think it is, and I think we can be unfair with that 2020 hindsight, but simply in answer to this question, it seems to me that we need to put ourselves in a position where we can do lots of things. Some of them are just going to be small, but can have big payoffs.
Ellen is on the line. Welcome, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. I really appreciate the show and your guests. I just wanted to say that I'm a little dismayed that it seems that even in your terrific program, you're reiterating to some extent the debate as one between Republicans and Democrats.
How do you see it, Ellen?
Well, it seems to me that when you've got people like Shelby, when you certainly have Republicans, people of good conscience on both sides of the aisle, who are saying that there is a need for an independent investigation here.
True.
That there's a lot to be learned from experience, and I think that it has been the stance of this administration to take offense at any questioning, which is, of course, as other guests have said, and part of the democratic process, and I think that that needs to be defended. And so in response to the question raised at the beginning of the program, can we afford to investigate this? I don't think we can afford not to. I think for the sake of an open society, it's terribly important that really two commissions be set up and that this not be allowed to be construed as a political or partisan battle. I don't really think it is. I think the stakes are very high, and I don't think when you've got both Republicans and Democrats calling for an investigation that it is anything but cynical.
All points well taken, Ellen, and our time is short, so let me give it to Jim Walsh, and thank you for your call. Ellen points out quite rightly that there are Republicans also calling for an investigation. In fairness, Dick Cheney himself says we should investigate, but he says not an independent commission, and he says I won't even give you the August 6th memo. So the implication is we're not going to lay everything out there. If this is between investigating openly and not investigating openly, Jim Walsh, what are we to make of White House claims that there's privileged information here that should not come out? What is the risk of that coming out and somehow denting national security going forward?
Well, two things on that, Tom. First, on is this a Democrat, Republican, or some other thing going on? Why are Republicans part of the call for a broader investigation? Well, because it's not only Democratic versus Republican, it's also the presidency versus the Congress. And the Congress feels that it has certain powers in the Constitution, and they're very jealous of those prerogatives. So they want to pursue them, and I think this is what we're starting to see now, and also some frustration with the Bush White House over holding information in the past. They feel like they haven't come clean, even in classified settings.
Of course, we know going all the way back to the Iran Contra investigation, Dick Cheney, who was then in Congress, has felt that the power has shifted too much to Congress, that the executive needs to have a greater cloak of secrecy. But let's get material and specific about that. If it doesn't have that cloak, could national security be damaged by an investigation?
Well, I think that there's a lot of loose talk about the national security implications of an investigation that isn't very well grounded. Mm-hmm. Most people, the metaphor in their mind is they think of the Cold War. And they think, well, if we talk too much, our enemies are going to learn something, and that's going to help them somehow. So the last thing we want to do is help our enemies. But the first thing we want to do is help ourselves defeat our enemies. That requires an investigation. This is not the Cold War. In the Cold War, we had intelligence operatives in Eastern Europe and Russia, and we had what was called a sources and methods issue. We didn't want to reveal too much in public because we wouldn't want our spies to be rolled up in those countries.
But why isn't that an issue with al-Qaeda, with the Islamic terrorist networks?
Because that is not the source of our information. We don't have a lot of operatives in Al-Qaeda.
Great.
Our information...
We have nothing to hide, unfortunately.
Well, our information is based on other sources. It's based on interviews with prisoners. Mm-hmm. It's based on the signal intelligence. It's based on all those documents that were collected in abandoned safe houses in mm-hmm. Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So we have a wholly independent source of information. And even where there's sensitive information, what is it, 5% or 10% of the total, you can handle that through simple classification procedures we've used for years, sanitizing documents, taking out the names but leaving the rest of the document. There are many ways to deal with this in a reasonable way.
Jim Walsh, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming on tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Jim Walsh is political scientist and research fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Jack Beatty, last word goes to you. Just a couple of seconds here. Are we going to have a thorough investigation?
Well, I don't know. But opposite Ellen's point, the Weekly Standard, a conservative magazine, made a vigorous case for an independent commission over the weekend, saying, you know, we investigate people for not paying their Social Security taxes for nannies. This involves something much bigger.
So let's get busy.
Yes.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on forums. In a moment, President Bush takes on Fidel Castro in a fiery speech in Miami. Hang with us, Jack. This is On Point. Today, in speeches in Washington and Miami, President Bush made it very clear that he will not heed the call Jimmy Carter made last week in Havana to lift the embargo against Cuba. The speeches laid out a set of conditions that must be met, Bush said, before the Bush administration would change the embargo policy, including monitored elections, the release of political prisoners, and a national referendum on free speech. Here's an excerpt from the speech given this afternoon in Miami, where President Bush addressed an enthusiastic crowd largely made up of Cuban Americans.
We stand here today to declare loud and clear to the entire world, Cuba must not only be independent, Cuba must be free. One 100 years ago, Cuba declared her independence, and nearly 50 years ago, nearly a half century ago, Cuba's independence and the hopes for democracy were hijacked by a brutal dictator who cares everything for his own power and nada for the Cuban people. In an era where markets have brought prosperity and empowerment, this leader clings to a bankrupt ideology that has brought Cuba's workers and farmers and families nothing, nothing but isolation and misery. I was amazed to read in this modern era, the Cuban regime banned the sale of computers to the public. What does that tell you? And in an era where every other nation in our hemisphere has chosen the path to democracy, every nation in our hemisphere has chosen the path to democracy, this leader instead chooses to jail, to torture, and exile Cuban people for speaking their minds. But the amazing thing is, through all the pains, the Cuban people's aspirations for freedom are undiminished. We see this today in Havana, where more than 11,000 brave citizens have petitioned their government for a referendum on basic freedoms. If that referendum is allowed, it can be a prelude to real change in Cuba. This country has no designs on Cuba's sovereignty. We have no designs on the sovereignty of Cuba. But we'll continue to be a strong and consistent supporter
of the Cuban people's aspirations for freedom. And nowhere is that support stronger than right here in the streets of Miami, Florida. The support will never wave here, and it's not going to wave in my heart either. For how long it takes. After all, we fight for freedom here in America. We love freedom. We love what freedom means. It is the cornerstone of our country. And therefore, we will never stop in our search for ways to advance freedom in Cuba. Earlier today in La Casa Blanca, I announced an initiative for a new Cuba that offers Cuba's government a way forward toward democracy and hope and better relations with the United States. Cuba is scheduled to hold elections to its National Assembly in 2003. I challenge Cuba's government to make these elections free and to make them fair. To make them free and fair, they must give opposition candidates the freedom to organize, assemble, and speak. They must give them the chance to open up the airway so they can get their message out to the people. To make them free and fair, they must release all political prisoners so they can participate in the elections. In order to make sure we know if they're free and fair, they must let human rights organizations into Cuba to make sure that the elections are free and fair. Once the 2003 elections are certified as free and fair by international monitors, once Cuba begins the process of meaningful economic reform, then and only then I will explore ways with the United States Congress to ease economic sanctions.
That was President Bush speaking earlier today in Miami. You can listen to the entire speech at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, the President of the United States, all fired up.
Yeah, all stick, but carrot at the end. The idea of a quid pro quo. We're going to if you want trade with the United States, here's what you've got to do. And in the leak for this in the Wall Street Journal before the speech, they were saying he'd be satisfied with incremental measures. In other words, they don't have to go the whole hog. Castro doesn't have to go into retirement. But if this election is free, if there's an opening, if the people who aren't, the 11,000 courageous people who signed that petition aren't jailed, these would be signed. So you sense the president is, he's giving red meat to that audience, but he's also trying to indicate we are shifting. Even he is shifting.
So does that mean quietly George Bush and Jimmy Carter are riding the same pony here?
I think there's no doubt that Carter's trip affected Bush, that they shifted their policy slightly. The emphasis, there is a carrot element and this notion you don't have to do everything at once. And for incremental steps, you'll get incremental benefits. That seems to me a pretty prudent policy.
Sounded like the president was glad to be back to a manageable size problem. That whole Texas twang came back. He was staying in the red meat, as you said.
Yeah, he certainly was. And, of course, he owes his election to the 66,000 Cuban-Americans who in 96 voted for Bill Clinton, but who, because of Elian Gonzalez, shifted around for Bush in 2000.
With Cubans have not been afraid to point to that whole election fiasco in the U.S. when President Bush points fingers at their lack of elections.
Quite right.
Jack Beatty, great to have you on tonight. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.